All right. Wow. So that was an inspirational overview of cosmology, and I feel like we should all just be rushing out to solve the next generation of CMB problems. But we still have some time, so I'm going to talk today about mapping dark matter on the largest and the smallest scales. And so I'm going to sort of zero in for the first half of my talk about just one piece of Francois's talk that went past, because I really think it's an amazing thing to be thinking about. And so CMB lensing is, it has a lot of promise, and it's going to be extremely powerful in the next few years. So on an unrelated note, so I'm at McGill University, but I'm actually moving to Illinois in the fall. So people have been asking. So I'm currently at something I like to call McGillinois. I'm in the process of moving. So a lot of the stuff that I've done, so Yuki Omori is a grad student at McGill. He's done a bunch of the stuff that I'm going to talk about today. And Yasher Hezeveh was a grad student at McGill. He's now a Hubble Fellow at Stanford. And he's done a bunch of the stuff that I'm going to talk about in the second half. Okay, so here's my summary and my outline. So here it is in words. So I'm going to first talk about CMB lensing. So this is mapping basically dark matter on the largest scales. And so since this conference, one of the goals of this is to talk about next generation cosmological probes. While it's true that we have current data on CMB lensing, it's going forward, it's going to be much better. And also strong lensing of high Z star forming galaxies is what I think is the best way to map dark matter on very small scales. And so I work on both of these things. Now, if you want to think about this visually, here's a visual version of this same slide. So here is a different version of the map that Francois just showed of CMB lensing. And I just want you to think very carefully about what this map is. This is an all-sky map of the dark matter density along the line of sight. So if you just pick any direction on the sky and you say, how much dark matter is over there? You can just go download this map and it'll tell you how much dark matter there is everywhere. And so then you would say, okay, well that's interesting, because now you can start saying things like, well, so here's some lump of matter in the universe. I wonder how many galaxies live in that overdensity. That's one thing you could do. Another thing you could do is you could say, I wonder whether gravitational lensing on large scales really is what we think general relativity says it is. And you can say, oh, well, I see a big lump of galaxies over there. Is it doing gravitational lensing on large scales the way you would expect general relativity to be doing things? Or you could say, I think that that big lump of mass right here should have some redshift space distortions that are coming from the growth of structure. Or you could say, I have some theory for how much large-scale structure there is in the universe as a function of time. And what this is it's a map of all of the structure in the universe. You have an integral of all of the structure in the universe. You just add it all up and you say, is there enough large-scale structure? And as he said, it's a 40 sigma measurement right now. And that's, as I'll show you later on, that's with a not particularly good map. Like, this is an inspirational map, but the signal noise in this is of order one. So this is going to be in, so maybe not on an all-sky map, but there already exist maps from things like the South Pole Telescope over patches that are about that big that have a signal noise that's maybe almost 10 times higher than this. That exists already on small patches. So that's the first half. This thing right here, so this is actually, I grabbed this. This was the astronomy picture of the day once. So this is, there's three things that are being shown here. In red and orange, what you're seeing is an ALMA image of a dusty star-forming galaxy at reasonably high redshifts. In blue, what you're seeing is an HST image of just sort of a regular old galaxy that's not particularly interesting in any way. What this dot is right here is showing the location of a 10 to the 9 solar mass small substructure, probably in this lens galaxy, that we can only see gravitationally. So if you had gravitational eyes, you would see this lump of matter right here. And the only reason we could see it is by using these ALMA observations. And this is something that over the next few years is something we're going to be able to do hundreds of times. So this is why I think that going forward, this is really interesting. And then you can start thinking about, well, I have some really interesting theory of dark matter. I wonder what it says about what the properties are of lumps like this and how they vary as a function of offset from the host, and how they vary as a function of mass. So just thinking about what is an interesting constraint on theory going forward, I think this is a really interesting one. Okay, so I'm gonna talk mainly about gravitational lensing. That's the theme for all these things. So just to remind you, this is the geometry of gravitational lensing. So first, let's talk about CMB lensing. So CMB lensing says you look at some spot in the sky, but you're not actually looking at the last scattering surface at that location because it propagated through the universe and photons got deflected. It actually came from slightly further over. So when you write that out, it says that you're looking at a slightly different spot than you think you are, and there's some, it's the gradient of some potential, so as long as it's just the Born approximation and a small deflections all the way, you can just write it as a single potential. And so this is the same thing that's done with weak gravitational lensing of galaxies. You just get some, you're getting some deflections and you're measuring some of those. It's done in a different way. The CMB is unique in several respects. So one, we know extremely well what the CMB looks like statistically. That those power spectra you saw tell us that we know very precisely what the expected properties of the CMB are, at least when you average over the whole sky. This gravitational lensing is happening for a source which is at an extremely well-known redshift. So I think the constraint on the redshift of last scattering is something like plus or minus 0.4. And you think, well, 0.4 is actually a pretty horrible redshift determination, right? If someone said a galaxy is at redshift 0.5 plus or minus 0.4, that wouldn't be very impressive. But what makes it impressive is that it's something like 1089 plus or minus 0.4. It's known. All the photons to, well, not all of them, but most of the photons are all coming from the same redshift. And this is the highest redshift you can access using photons. So in principle, if we could actually measure gravitational lensing of the gravitational wave background, you could probably push a little bit further back. But this is basically as far back as you're going to get for measuring structure in the universe, which means everything in the universe is in front of the CMB, for our purposes at least. So to give you a sense of where the CMB lensing kernel peaks, so this is the CMB lensing kernel. It's just the contribution to CMB lensing as a function of redshift. And what you see is that it has this broad support, sort of it starts to rise at a redshift of 1, and then it has this very long tail going out to very high redshift. So what you see is you're getting an integral over high redshift structure that's for the most part well behind things that you're going to be probing with any sort of a galaxy survey. So galaxy surveys, you know, there are surveys that go out to here, and you have quasar surveys that go out, but for the most part, you're probing a very interesting part of large-scale structure. So it's very nicely complementary to existing and ongoing, well, these are all planned, but it's a nice complement to lower redshift studies that people are generally going to be doing. So Francois showed you the map of what happens when CMB lensing happens. That you see everything deflects a little bit. And you might say, well, how in the heck can you actually measure gravitational lensing of the CMB, given that it's a Gaussian random field being deflected by some basically Gaussian random field? You might think that almost, you know, purely random, convolved with purely random, would be something that's very hard to interpret. But in reality, it's something that is not so bad. And the way to think about, at least for me, of what's going on is that CMB lensing generates some sort of mode coupling when you integrate over the sky. So in math, you say, well, you do this, you do some Taylor expansion, and you get that the what you see is this plus some deflection. And if you were to Fourier transform this and go into k-space, then what you see is you're going to have this term right here, where you get grad t getting convolved with grad phi in Fourier space. And so if you were to then do some two-point operator in Fourier space, you'll find that you have this piece right here that's coming from here that's saying that what you did is you took some amount of the unlensed CMB and you mixed it around. So that's sort of the math version of it, sort of what I think is a slightly more intuitive version of this, is that if this is the Fourier transform of the CMB, there's going to be some spot in the CMB that's been either stretched or squashed. So imagine you have some image, you stretch it. Well, if you stretch it, all you've done is in Fourier space, you've stretched it or compressed it. If you stretch the sky, you compress it in Fourier space. And that says you have some mode. And if all you did was do some stretching or squishing of the CMB, in that area of the sky, you just took some power that was intrinsically here and you moved it to here. And similarly, some different distortion would take some power from this spot and move it somewhere else. So locally, you're moving power around. So when you do some, when you look at your entire map, you'll find that there's some little bit of power right here that, because some small part of your sky got squished, is actually power that got mixed out from here. So you basically just go around and you look for correlations in Fourier space that say how much of my sky over here looks like it actually got subtly shifted out from over here. And you use that to reconstruct your lensing potential. And so there, you, to do it properly, you want to optimize it for signal noise, you downweight things, and so there's a machinery in place to do it, but in general, the smoking gun is you're just looking for some very subtle correlations in K-space, you use that to map out your lensing potential. And so that's how you make maps like this, is you just look for all the spots in the sky where the CMB power spectrum got screwed up a little bit. So here's the Planck version. So with SPT, we have a version, the South Pole Telescope. I'll show you a picture of that, just because this is what I work on. So there's our lensing map over 2,500 square degrees. And you might say, well, we already have a map over the whole sky. Why are you making a map that's 2,500 square degrees? And the reason for that is because it's higher signal noise. So in this region, this map is probably something like maybe 2 to 3 times higher signal noise than this map. SPT pole, so this map was actually made several years after this map, and it's only 100 square degrees. And so it almost seems like we're going backwards to all sky, 2,500 square degrees, 100 square degrees. But the signal noise in this map right here, over about 100 square degrees, is approaching 8, something like that. This is probably something like an 8 or 9 sigma peak. So, you know, we're really mapping large-scale structure now. And then the question is, how do you go forward with this? What's the long-term future for this? And this is only going to get better. So, just to give you a sort of full disclosure, I work on the South Pole Telescope right now. So I'm going to try to stay agnostic and just sort of think about the future and not make this into a show-and-tell sort of thing. But there's the telescope. It's very beautiful. It's at the South Pole. And where we are right now is that we're about to install a new camera. So we're about to go from SPT pole, which has about 1,600 detectors, to SPT, the next generation of this, which is 15,000 detectors. So 10 times more detectors. And so what that means is that as long as it took us to generate this one, we'll be able to make this map, we'll be able to make 10 of these maps in the time it took us to do this one, which means we'll be able to build up this thing in something like maybe 2 to 3 years. So where are we today in the CMB lensing power spectrum, or almost today? There was a result that came out a couple days ago that's not on here. So the Lambda site actually has, it hosts plots of this things like the CMB lensing power spectrum or the B-mode power spectrum. So if you're worried that you're going to be biased by picking and choosing, you can just blame someone else for which stuff has been shown. So here is the lensing power spectrum, CL phi phi. So that's the projected gravitational potential. And then it's got these funny units out front. L plus 1. So L plus 1 is basically doing del squared. So del squared phi is telling you that you have convergence, which is a mass map. And then it's squared because it's a power spectrum. And this is versus multipole. And here it is. There's a bunch of experiment people that have reported these measurements. So ACT is in the Atacama Desert. So there's the Planck one. So these are what we just saw, basically, except the harmonic transform of it. So Polar Bear is also in Atacama, and these two things are now working together as the Simons array. It was just recently announced a couple days ago. SPT, and this is the temperature version, and here is temperature plus polarization. And so here you see that Planck, with that all-sky coverage, you just can't beat all-sky when you're talking about big L. When you're talking about, sorry, low L. When you're talking about large scales, you just can't beat an all-sky experiment. And so this is where they're just barely signal noise of order 1 is right around there. And then you see the error bars start to blow up a little bit. And you see that we're still sort of in this regime where we're just So partly this is because SPT pole, it has high signal to noise, but it's that little tiny patch of sky. So with a tiny little patch of sky, you're limited by sample variance, and that's what you're seeing right here, is the fact that with only 100 square degrees, you can't really measure an amplitude very well. But that's what's going to change as we go forward. So let's skip that stuff. So what might you want to do with this? What was that? Oh, I can show it to you. So here's where we currently are. So this is something that my student Yuki is working on. Hopefully we're trying to get it out as quickly as we can. So he's doing a combined SPT plus Planck temperature map and then turning that into a lensing map. And that's what this is. And so he has a funny taste in colors, but you have to let students find their way, right? And so here's the power spectrum from that. So this is an interesting comparison just because, so here's the power spectrum on our 2,500 square degree chunk, which is these purple points. Red is the full sky Planck map. And what you see is that at large scales, low L, it's just you would wonder why we're doing the experiment, but that's just because we're on 2,500 square degrees instead of on the full sky. And so this is just sample variance. And then you see that once you get out to L of a few hundred, you're seeing that just on 2,500 square degrees, the error bars compared to Planck are substantially smaller. And that's just because it's a much higher signal noise lensing map. And so the future of this stuff is that these error bars are just going to get smaller and smaller as the experiments get better and as we do larger sky. So that's where we are right now. And so out here is where we're starting to run into some foreground troubles, and we're trying to figure out exactly what to do with our foreground troubles out there. Oh, you mean this one? Well, so there's, so that's the famous, I don't know how famous it is. This is a Planck L of, 600 or something? And I don't know the answer to that one. I mean, it is what it is. But it's there. It's definitely there that, so Yuki has his own pipeline for generating as many lensing maps, and it doesn't matter what combination you do. It's definitely true that there's a weird dip in power at this L right here. And so it doesn't seem to be there in our 2,500 square degree data, but it actually is there in the ACT data. So if you go back to that compilation and you really squint, so L of 600, so it's basically this thing right here. So in log space, it doesn't look so bad, but you see it's also, there's a big dip right here. And so this is in the SPT 2012. And in the ACT one, it's also low somewhere down there. Maybe it's not even on the plot, but who knows? Statistics are funny, but yeah, I mean, it's not in this one, right? And in fact, if you do the Planck map in just our 2,500 square degree patch, it's not there. So whatever it is, it's in some part of the sky that we don't know anything, that we don't, from SPT, don't know anything about. It's not, well, it's right here, right? So in this patch of the sky, it's not in the Planck map. That if you do the power spectrum of just the Planck map in our patch of the sky, there's no problem at L of 600. We don't see it in our combined map either. We don't see it in our data, but that just says that it is somewhere on the sky, and you could go find where it is. There are parts of the sky that clearly just have very low variance at L of 600. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, I think that the Planck, a lot of Planck analyses, they cut off around here for reasons that I'm not quite sure of. It's not just because this point is low.
We have an objective way.
Yeah.
Look at the curve.
Ah-ha-ha.
The curve.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has something that is not completely
kosher. Yeah. So they start to fail their null tests right, I think, on this point. Yeah. But, most of the signal noise in this Planck measurement is actually down here anyway. That if you just say, what is the constraint on this amplitude, it's driven by these points right here. If you just say, what's the constraint? So it's not a big deal to throw out these points. It's just, it's nice to be able to show them. So what can you do with this? Well, So what people have done for a very long time is you take your CMB lensing maps of various forms, and it actually started using WMAP. So Kendrick did this way back when, where he just took the WMAP lensing map in all its glory, and he compared it with various tracers of large-scale structure, like the NVSS survey and things like that. And so there's a long history dating all the way back to not almost 10 years now, people have been doing this, which isn't a long history in the scale of CMB, but of people saying, well, we have this lensing map, let's compare this with galaxies and just see what we have. So a version of that, so the one that I'm most familiar with, is we're doing this with the South Pole Telescope and the Dark Energy Survey. So just as an example of how you do it, so the Dark Energy Survey has a galaxy map. So this is the galaxy density in their sample, in their SV data, which is the science verification. And so this is their funky mask, and it kind of looks like a little monster, and there's his eyes, and he's kind of coming along. So here is lensing convergence. Here's CMB lensing. This is the SPT lensing map in the same, more almost the same mask, but not quite. And this is the Dark Energy Survey shear data. So they actually measure shapes of galaxies and use this as a way to map out the dark matter density between us and the galaxies. And you can do all sorts of things, like compare these things with each other, because some of the structure is in common. So the stuff at redshift of maybe 0.5 is stuff that's in both, is lensing both distant galaxies and the CMB. So there should be some correlation there. And so you can do comparisons there. You can also compare the how the galaxies, where the galaxies live compared to the lumps of dark matter in either your CMB lensing map or in your shear maps. So this is where we are, is we're just kind of wading through. And so we're doing it with SPT. So this has happened with Planck and also is going on with ACT. And in all these things, what you see is that there are very you're really mapping out the relation between galaxies and dark matter very well. This relation between shear and CMB lensing is only in the early days. We're talking, two sigma detections, whatever you want to call them. Hints of that the correlations make sense, but there's still lots to be done. But all this data is going to just be getting much better very fast. So the Dark Energy Survey is going to do more area, and then with LSST coming and Euclid, these are going to become extremely interesting things to study. So just be aware that these things are coming, and in the spirit of future cosmological probes, it's an interesting thing to keep your eye on. All right, so what's coming next? So for CMB lensing, so this is just a plot that Alex Van Engelen put together as part of the S4 proposal. So CMB S4 is the next generation CMB experiment after this one that we're doing now. So SPT 3G is the camera we're currently installing. So that would be sort of a stage 3 experiment. Where we are now, so Planck turns out to have a noise curves that just barely tick the signal right about here. And that's comparable to what we are with EB only. So we talked about EB mixing, and so this is what a current SPT pole can do using just the polarization information. And what you see is that actually SPT pole using just polarization information actually isn't that great of a CMB lensing experiment. It hurts me to say it because I work on the experiment and we did a lot of work on this. It's just, it doesn't have the signal noise because polarization is a really hard thing to measure accurately. And I said that lensing map had all this high signal noise. Where is that coming from? Well, what that's coming from is this curve right here, which is the stage 2 TT, which is this curve right here. So when I said that SPT pole had high signal noise, that was saying that the noise was well below the signal out here on degree scale, on few degree scales, but that was using just the temperature lensing. But going forward, so then you go to stage 4 using just temperature lensing, and we'll end up going from this curve right here to this curve right here, which means temperature is effectively tapped out. So this is also what Francois was saying, is that we're kind of running out of things to do with the temperature measurements of the CMB. But stage 4, the EB part of it, is going to go from being what we can currently do to being down here. And so you see that in EB, there's sort of, and in fact, as the experiments get better, these noise curves are just going to keep going down and down and down. So it means that the, not the current generation, but certainly for stage four experiment, out to L of 1,000, you're going to have a reliable map over a big chunk of the sky. So when people talk about S4, they're talking about mapping most of the useful sky. And if that means having multiple experiments, some in the south and some in the north, then that's what you have to do. So just as a comparison point, here's the same curve, the same plot, and here's from a paper just doing the same thing using cosmic shear for something like HSC, but it's basically like a pretty good cosmic shear survey, and it's the same thing. It's CL of the lensing versus L, and what you see is this is in three different tomography bins, and these are the noise levels. And you see that CMB lensing is gonna be just like a cosmic shear experiment in terms of signal noise, except that it's gonna be mainly sensitive to stuff at redshift 3 instead of stuff at redshift of 0.5 to 1.5. So there's a really nice complementarity that's coming where we'll really be able to map these things out. The high Z structure, the low Z structure, everything's gonna fit together really nicely. All right, so that was part one. Part two is I'm gonna talk about strong lensing. So here's the classic strong lens. If you go to the Wikipedia, you'll see something that looks like this. And it's just coming from multiple paths. They all go through the lens. So you can see a single image get split into, in this case, four. And what can you do with it? So I'm gonna motivate this instead of just saying how, with the tool, I'm gonna say an example of why you might be interested in this sort of thing. So there's this possible thing, well, there is a thing called the missing satellite problem. Whether it's actually a problem or not depends on who you are and what you think, and people argue about how much of a problem it is, but it's definitely true that if you run an n-body simulation and you look at and you see something that looks like a galaxy, what you invariably see is a swarm of satellites that are orbiting around. And this would be all dark matter. If instead you look in our galaxy and you see our galaxy, there's a disk, there's not a huge swarm of satellites. So recently the numbers have gone up with the dark energy survey, but it's still, there's still clearly a problem that you don't see nearly as many satellites orbiting around our galaxy as you would if you were to just do a straight census of the number of satellites around a typical galaxy in a cold dark matter simulation. There are possible solutions, and this is why I say whether it's a problem or not sort of depends on who you are. So there are sort of two camps of people that say this isn't a problem. Two possible solutions. One is that that in dark matter it really does look like this, but there's some sort of baryonic effects that make it the case that most of these satellites don't host any stars. And that says that if you're going to look in using optical light, you're not going to see stuff that's only dark matter. So the idea is that that these satellites are there, but you just can't see them. So that's option one. Option two is that there's something interesting about dark matter that has gotten rid of most of these satellites. So those are the two families of solutions. And then the question is, so what do you do with that? Well, so what you need is you need some way to map out the dark matter distribution. So CMB lensing is not going to work in this case because the scale of a galaxy is going to be a few arcseconds across. And the CMB lensing stuff we were talking about, the beam of SPT, which is a 10-meter telescope, is a one arc minute beam. So you need something else. And so what people have noticed is that you can use gravitational lensing to do this. And so here is a simulated gravitational lens. And so the different colors here correspond to slightly different, if you have some source that's some multicolor source, for instance, it would get distorted slightly differently at different spots because it's gone through a slightly different potential. And so here is a possible image, and I'm gonna tell you that a lump of matter has been placed somewhere in the gravitational potential. And I think you can probably take a guess of roughly where it is. So by eye, you have done a substructure finding algorithm, and you can tell me that there's a little lump of, there's clearly something going on in the image up there, right? And nothing has really changed down here very much. There's been a little bit of a sort of a global expansion because we've added a little bit of mass. But for the most part, what's really happened is just weird stuff happened in particular to this image right here. So that's the idea. So this was a big, this was a relatively large lump. And so now you've reduced the problem to just saying, okay, well now we just need to get a really good image of a gravitational lens and go looking for lumps. So that's been done. And so it's been done in the past. And the problem is they just kind of ran out of lenses. So Neil Dalal and Kachanik did it with a sample of radio sources, and they did it for something like a handful, maybe six or something like that. It's been done a little bit using IR observations with Keck, and there's evidence for maybe a lump in that one. So it's been done a few times, but there just hasn't been a big sample of lenses around. Now, so I told you about the South Pole Telescope. And one of the things that we found out is that it's actually super easy to find strong lenses using a millimeter, submillimeter wave survey. And so we actually now have a list of more than 100 or so new systems that we are pretty sure are strong gravitational lenses that we could do this substructure search with. And so here's an example of one of them. So here's a galaxy, and then these are all my images on top, and what you see is that there's an Einstein ring around this galaxy image with HST. And so why is this so easy? And it was kind of, it's almost embarrassingly easy how finding these objects. And it really just comes down to, it turns out that order of magnitude about 10 to the minus 5 of the sky is strongly lensed. And so if you just pick a random spot and say, what's the probability that, that spot would be able to be forming an Einstein radius? It's about a 10 in a million chance. And so if you just look at the distribution of distant, dusty star-forming galaxies, it has this very sharp edge. And this sharp edge is this sort of, it turns out to be really lucky. Because normally most distributions of galaxies don't have a sharp edge. And the reason they don't have a sharp edge normally is because there's, no matter how rare your bright objects are, you're always going to get stuck with some nearby faint object that happens to be bright. And so it means that because you always have like these relatively nearby, intrinsically faint, but happen to just look bright because they're close, you end up filling this part of the tail in with sort of fairly faint but nearby things. And so, but for dusty star-forming galaxies, there seems to have been some weird process that at redshift 2, they just stopped forming. Which means there's a sharp edge to this distribution that comes from the fact that there aren't too many that are very, very intrinsically luminous, and there aren't any dim ones nearby. And so it gives you the sharp edge to the distribution, and it means that you take 10 to the minus 5 of these fairly normal ones, and you boost them by a factor of, say, 10 in flux out to here, and you now have this population out here that are all strongly lensed. So it's the easiest lens-finding algorithm ever. You just make a map of the sky, you find all your bright objects, and you write them down, and you now have a lens sample. It works extremely well. So if you just take the brightest objects in the map, so it turns out they are all either strong lenses or nearby galaxies with NGC numbers. So it becomes a very easy pruning. And so we have, 100 and something of these objects, and you follow them up and you find that a bunch of them are strongly lensed. And Herschel did the same thing. So Herschel also discovered this. So about the same time that we were realizing this, Herschel was also discovering these sources. And so there is now, big samples of these things. And then SDP81 is a galaxy that, one of those Herschel galaxies, and there's the ALMA image. So that's an ALMA image of SDP81. And there were lots of press releases on it of people doing all sorts of interesting things with it, which I didn't read because I wasn't interested in them. But we wanted to do the substructure search. So other people didn't do this substructure search. And so Yasher Hezaveh built a pipeline for searching for substructures. And it's a computationally intensive thing. Because data is complicated, That's what that means. And so you can reconstruct the source, and it's a mess. So this is actually what that source intrinsically looks like. If it hadn't been lensed, it would be this weird splotchy thing, because it's this galaxy that's under, where the whole galaxy is undergoing star formation. It's this cataclysmic event where this whole object is massively undergoing star formation. And then by the time it's done being lensed, it ends up looking like this. So you take that sort of two-lobe thing and you lens it and you get something that looks like that. And then what we noticed was that you could fit a smooth model or a perturbed model. And you could just say, is there a lump of mass anywhere in here? And so what I'm showing right here is, so let's just concentrate on the top panels. So this is in band 6, so that's one of the ALMA bands we used. If you just fit a smooth model, here is the best fit smooth model. Here's the best fit perturbed model. And they look very similar to the eye, and that's just saying that you can do a pretty good job of fitting the data without adding a lump on its own. But if you do add a lump of matter and you say, is there a lump anywhere in here? What you find is that right here, the difference between these two models is exactly this thing that I was saying, where you've pushed images out relative to each other. So you put a little lump of mass right here, and what that did is it pushed flux out. So it pushes that flux out, and what we can say is that the chi-squared difference in the fit to the data between these two models is about 50. So by adding one lump of substructure, we improved our chi-squared by a factor of 50 by putting a lump of substructure right there. And so we declare that to be a detection of a 10 to the 9 solar mass lump of mass at this location. And so this was just with this one lens and just saying, where in here could we put anything? And there was another spot that, you know, so we didn't find strong evidence for anything else. So we found a lump out here at 10 to the 9 solar masses. We didn't find any smaller ones. If there had been smaller ones in a few spots, we would have found them. And the reason we would have found them is because there are spots in this image where a very small perturbation would have been detectable. So there are spots where if these two images were very different, especially where it's very bright, it would have shown up as a big residual, and it just didn't. So with that one thing, we can say, well, we have some mass function of substructure that you can normalize depending by saying where could we have found one if it was there. And it's all upper limits except for right here we found something. And then you compare this with N-body simulations, and so this is a paper by these authors, and this is actually using N-body simulations to put limits on, to actually measure what this mass function should look like, and what they say it should look like is something like this. So with this one object, it turns out we saw one lump that turns out to be about what you would expect, and we didn't see any extra ones in that one object. So what we need is we need more of these things, and we have more than 100 of these things just sitting there. And so these things are going to be there forever. So it's a question of getting the time on the telescope to go look for these things. And how sensitive these things are to dark matter is going to depend a lot on the details of that lensing configuration. So you need it to be, these Einstein rings are nice, but there's, as you vary the properties of the lens, some of them will be more or less sensitive to dark matter. And so what we find is that when we run our simulations, that there are some objects, so right here, so here's a N-body in blue, and ray tracing of an ALMA observation, of a simulated ALMA observation in red, what you find is that this object right here, what you find is, so in this thing, you see there's a big lump right here, this is the main body, and you have satellite, 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 and these are the positions of those satellites. And what you find is that in this particular setup, when you do ray tracing through this whole box, well, you don't see this one right here, and you don't see this one because there's no flux there. If you have no measurement nearby, you're not going to notice that something funny is going on here. This one was a little bit too small to do very much, and it wasn't right on there. This one was too far off center. These ones were small. This one right here actually perturbed this image enough that we could reliably say, aha, there's a subhalo right there. And that particular subhalo for this simulated ALMA observation, we could reliably say it was 3 × 10⁸ solar masses, plus or minus something like 1. So we're really pushing into this interesting regime of subhalos. And so this is now a thing. So when you're thinking about future cosmological probes, there's now this thing which is a high-resolution mapping of substructures in lens galaxies. So go out and build your models for dark matter and figure out what's going on very small scales, because now there's data to constrain it. And it's not just saying we're doing this to solve the missing satellite problem, that we're actually going to be able to measure the properties and the abundance of subhalos as a function of positional offset from the centers of halos. So that's now a thing. That's a next generation cosmological probe, and it's at the exact opposite end of the spectrum from CMB lensing, where you're doing this very large scale stuff and you can be studying cosmological effects either of dark matter or of gravity. All right, I'm done.
So 10 to the 9 solar mass is right around the warm dark matter kind of thing. So have you looked in detail, and do you expect to rule out the warm dark matter directly with this? Or?
Well, so it also depends. It's a little tricky. Well, not tricky, but it's 10 to the 9 solar masses, but it also depends on what the host mass is. So what matters sometimes more than anything is the ratio of the host mass to the subhalo mass. And but in this case, you see that this looks exactly like cold dark matter. So does it rule out warm dark matter? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what we need this prediction for warm dark matter, and which must exist. So if you've got it, let me know.
Okay. More questions?
And I guess this plot is indicative of how low you can go in mass, like 10 to the 7 solar mass.
This shows how low we could go in some, we have no evidence that we can get below 10 to the 7. So we're confident we can get below 10 to the 8. In this particular system, we weren't very good at 10 to the 7. And the reason for that is just because what you need is you want regions that have extremely high magnification. So you want structures in you want very sharp features in these models. And the sharper your features, the better you can actually tell that they've been slightly offset. And how sharp these features are depends on the lens model, and it also depends on what the source looks like. So if you want a source, so the clumpier your source, the better you can do. And for that, you're just limited by what some galaxy halfway, three quarters of the way across the universe happens to be looking like. And for that, one of the limits of this is that actually we currently don't know enough about these objects to be confident how lumpy these things are. So we can't say the smallest scale feature we could ever detect here, just because we've never really, we haven't measured enough about these objects to be sure how small the structures are. So for this particular object, as low as we could go, realistically, where you see that we're a factor of almost 100 above where you would expected there to be there, which means you really would have needed one to be exact. There was one spot in that image where we would have seen it if it was there, and it wasn't there.
We have time for one more question. Mike.
Thing being in the halo versus in projection?
So if you look in an N-body in a CDM simulation, it's about a little under 10% chance that it's just along the line of sight. So it's not zero. I mean, in some ways, that's actually a feature, right? Because it means that there's a guaranteed signal. So it means that you're always going to find something, that there's at least some, if it turned out that this subhalo mass function was completely flat down here, it means that there is sort of this population of just free floating small halos along the line of sight that we could map out the mass function of, which would be fun.
Okay, let's thank Skill.